Welcome to Writer's Voice, a weekly radio show produced at the studios of WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our theme today is the toxins around us. We've heard how we're exposed through the cosmetics we and our children use, from lipstick to bubble bath and shampoos. My next guest has a very personal and tragic story to tell. In 1992, my next guest has a very personal and tragic story to tell. In 1992, journalist Nancy Nichols found out that her sister, then in her 40s, had just been diagnosed with a rare form of ovarian cancer. On her deathbed, her sister made Nichols promise to write about her illness and what they both thought might be the cause of it: massive pollution in their hometown of Waukegan, Illinois. Waukegan is located on Lake Michigan, and millions of pounds of PCBs and other toxic chemicals were dumped over decades into the lake's waters, contaminated the fish Nichols and her sister ate, the air they breathed, and the water they drank. While working on her sister's story, Nichols got her own diagnosis of a rare form of pancreatic cancer. She was 42. In her book, Lake Effect, Nichols connects her personal story to the larger one of how government and big business prized profits over health, and the journey Nichols traveled to understand why. Well, Nancy Nichols, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
Your sister was 41 when she was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, and you were diagnosed with cancer when you were 43, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
What made you suspect that your sister's cancer and then yours were caused by the toxic pollution you were both exposed to when you were kids?
Well, it's an interesting story. My sister, when she had ovarian cancer, asked me to write about her illness. In fact, it was a deathbed promise that made me start to really seriously investigate the pollution in our hometown and its possible links with the diseases she had, first endometriosis and then ovarian cancer. And I was about halfway into that book when my own cancer was diagnosed. I had a rare form of pancreatic cancer.
So you both grew up in Waukegan, Illinois. What made you link your cancers to the environment that you grew up in?
There were about 1 million pounds of polychlorinated biphenyls in my hometown. That's a chemical that was used in manufacturing. It's a lubricant. That chemical was banned as a cancer-causing agent by the federal government when I was just leaving high school in the late 1970s, early 1980s. So,
and this is PCBs.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. So it was not... There was 1 million pounds of PCBs on the lake. They were trucked to a landfill half a mile from our house. That landfill bordered the farm where we bought our vegetables. It bordered a restaurant where we ate and nursing home where my grandmother was. Eventually, there would be 3 Superfund sites in our hometown. It was not a huge leap to start to think about the environment and the cancers that we face.
When did it dawn on you? How did it dawn on you that there might be an environmental link?
I published my first piece as a journalist in the Chicago Tribune about the problems in my hometown in the early 1980s. I didn't really seriously start to connect them with personal illnesses until my sister was diagnosed in 1992. So it was about then that we started to think, wow, this isn't just an intellectual concern. It isn't a concern that you would have about your hometown. This is something that might personally have affected us.
And you were 8 when there was a huge die-off of fish in Lake Michigan.
That die-off of alewives was actually of biblical proportions. They washed ashore in huge numbers. There were literally 2 to 3 feet of dead fish on the beaches. And that happened all along the shores of Lake Michigan.
And what killed them?
And that's a complicated story. There are some people who believe that certainly the toxins in the lake were not helping them. They're fish that, actually a saltwater fish, and they're in Lake Michigan, of course, is a freshwater body. So they were unable to adapt to the changes. They're an invasive species. So some combination of toxicity and just maladaptive behavior killed them off.
And then Waukegan decided to stock the lake, to restock it, with coho salmon. Why was that problematic in terms of the problems, the cancers that you and your sister contracted, and the general problem of pollution, of exposures to pollution by the people around that area?
That's just such an interesting story about when, once you have a sort of disruption in the environment. So we had this invasive species of alewives, and then the states bordering the Great Lakes decided to stock a fish that would actually eat the alewife, so they picked this big, fatty coho salmon. And the idea of fighting one invasive to introduce another invasive, the coho salmon, was actually brilliant and wacky, and it worked. The problem is that the fish became an unbelievably good repository for the chemicals in the lake, so that they became an uninterrupted pathway between the chemicals in the lake bed and dinner plates all along the shores of Lake Michigan.
Tell us a little bit about what PCBs do, maybe before we go a little further. You know, we've had our own problems here in Western Massachusetts. General Electric has been charged with polluting towns nearby, actually in the Berkshires or between us and the Berkshires, with PCB pollution. Of course, there's pollution in the Hudson River. But for those of our listeners who aren't aware of what the problem is, tell us, what do PCBs do to us?
PCBs are a class of chemicals that are known as endocrine disruptors, which means that they can enter the body and either act like a human hormone or disrupt the function of a human hormone. So they've been known, for example, to accumulate in ovarian fluids. They are sometimes linked with reproductive disorders like infertility. So in my own case, in my sister's case, my sister had a disease called endometriosis, which is a reproductive disorder. I had infertility problems. Many of the things that would have been textbook examples of how PCBs affect, say, wildlife, then would showed up in my family.
You know, back when I was doing work as an environmental health educator, and this must have been in the 90s, studies came across my desk that said that about infertility, that sperm count was falling in men, had in fact fallen by half in the early 1990s over the previous 50 years. And in fact, some researchers thought that if the trend continued, most men would be infertile within the next 50 years. Infertility was a real issue. Tell us a little bit more about that for you.
In my case, it was not an issue with my husband. It was not an issue of sperm count, although I'm familiar with the studies that you're suggesting. In my case, I was able to have one child, but just never able to have another. It's what people call sort of unexplained fertility. But what I write about in my book, Lake Effect, is thinking about, we know, for example, that infertility in birds would increase if they had eaten the fish in the lake, and that also women who have eaten a great deal of Lake Michigan fish had longer, it took them longer to conceive if, in fact, they were able to conceive. So what I did in the book was talk a lot about my personal story, but try to link it to what we know to be the research on women who have eaten Great Lakes fish.
And also an impact on learning disorders.
That I have no personal experience with, and I have to be very grateful for that. My son is quite healthy. But I think that is a major thing that the scientists and public health officials are really concerned about. Many people think it's an epidemic that's linked to toxics like the ones I was exposed to as a child, but also many more chemicals that are prevalent today.
Now, you mentioned endometriosis before. Tell us what that is and tell us what it feels like to have it.
Endometriosis is an extremely painful disease. It gives you very painful periods. And what it is it's when the uterine tissue moves outside the walls of the uterus and perhaps attaches to an ovary or is in that cavity somewhere in your abdominal cavity. And it should not be there. So when you get your period, it swells and sometimes bleeds a tiny bit and causes scarring and can be very painful. And my sister had it, as do many, about 5 million women, I believe, in America have it.
You know, there was another thing that I found particularly affecting among many, many things that you recount in your book, and that was the dilemma, the kind of Hobson's choice you faced around, or that you thought, at least, that you faced around fertility. It was difficult for you to become pregnant with your first child, and a doctor told you that you should take fertility drugs. What was the issue there?
The way it happened was my sister was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and as many of your listeners may know, once your sister is diagnosed with that disease, often the sibling is catapulted into medical treatment at the same time. There were many doctors at the time who thought I should immediately have my ovaries removed because of my sister's diagnosis. I chose not to do that and tried to have a child. Then it took me a very long time to have that child, and people thought that I should try fertility treatments. At the time, and this was in the early 1990s, there was a fair amount of research that the drugs being used at the time could perhaps be connected with ovarian cancer, so that I would have been in this bizarre situation of having to take a drug that might give me ovarian cancer in order to have my child so that I could have my ovaries removed immediately so that I would not get ovarian cancer. And it was an unusual situation, to say the least.
And if you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nancy Nichols about her book, Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. You know, I wrote a study a long time ago. As I said, I was a worker, an environmental health educator, worked on worker health and safety. I wrote a study a long time ago for OSHA during the Carter administration, when it was under the direction of Eula Bingham. And OSHA and the EPA were pretty progressive agencies that worked together under the Carter administration. And I remember when Ronald Reagan came in, and my study and everything else that people had been working on kind of dropped like a stone from the public consciousness and the consciousness of government itself. Talk about what happened to the EPA with Ann Gorsuch.
That was such a sea change, and I was a young reporter also. My town of Waukegan, Illinois, had a little starring role in that, and that one of the administrators from the EPA had come out and tried to cut a backdoor deal with the polluters in my town. Ultimately, there was a congressional investigation of that woman and of the head of EPA, Ann Gorsuch. Both of them were forced to resign. One of them ultimately did some prison time. I think the interesting thing about that was that they went in and they tried to dismantle the EPA enforcement and were somewhat successful. And certainly it is not the aggressive agency that it was once envisioned to be. And currently, Superfund, which is the federal legislation that would clean up sites like the one in my hometown and the ones you've suggested earlier in Western Mass, it has not been refunded by Congress.
Your book is both a compelling personal story as well as a story of regulatory indifference to these problems. You write about something, you call it the social construction of ignorance. What do you mean by that?
That was a term coined by a man named Robert Proctor. And what he is saying, and what I was saying in the book, is that in the same way we create science so that we can understand certain truths or relationship, we can create ignorance by what we choose to study and what we choose not to study. So in my hometown, for example, there has never been a long-term study of the effects of the chemicals there. And that sort of lack of data, the lack of attention to the data that would have given us information to move forward, either as individuals or on a regulatory front, has been duplicated over and over again in this country. Now, most recently, the Centers for Disease Control had a study of the 43 areas of concern around the Great Lakes, and that study showed increases of incidence of cancer around these degraded environmental areas. Well, instead of releasing the report, a very highly acclaimed scientist was asked to leave the CDC. Eventually, that report did come out, but there is certainly a resistance to documenting and discussing what we know to be the issues around environmental health.
You not only have a compelling personal story in the book, but you also talk about what has been going on in this country around all these issues of environmental regulation. When Reagan came in, regulation went out.
It was a sea change in the Reagan administration. When they came into office, there were two women at the EPA who were very high up. One was Rita Lavelle, and she was head of the Superfund program, which is charged with cleaning up the highly degraded areas that are on the national priorities list. She met with polluters in my hometown in Waukegan and tried to do a backdoor negotiation. It became quite a scandal. Her whole running of the program and the office immediately above her would be Ann Gorsuch, and her ability to run the department was called into question. She got into quite a tussle with Congress, and eventually there was some allegations that she was hiding information, and both of them were removed from office.
So was this a case, Nancy Nichols, of the fox guarding the chicken coop?
It was certainly a case where people who were put into office had tremendous contacts with industry, and many of the people at the time who were serving in the Reagan administration in the EPA came from companies who were polluters, who had their own Superfund site issues.
And I'm speaking with Nancy Nichols about her memoir, Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. You know, there's been a lot of concern growing about the chemical bisphenol A, which is a plasticizer put into plastics to harden them. It's also an endocrine disruptor, and it goes into things like baby bottles and sippy cups. In August, the FDA came out with a draft report saying that at the low levels of exposure, kids were not at risk. Could you talk a little bit about this whole issue of low levels of exposure? Because that's often what we hear. We hear, well, you know, yeah, maybe this chemical has some problems, but people aren't getting enough of it.
I think there are two ways to think about this. One is, you know, it's a dose response issue, so you have to have a whole lot of it to hurt you. So think about aspirin, right? You can take it a little bit every day, and it might help your heart condition. But if you were to take three or four bottles in one day, it would hurt you quite a bit. So that's a dose response. And people have also often thought, or for a long time believed, that chemicals work the same way. So a little bit of something like bisphenol A that you might get in a water bottle simply could not hurt you. There's a new science of low-dose toxicity that says, actually, some of these things are active in very, very small parts, maybe parts per million even. And that is consistent with other things we know about pharmaceuticals. So if any of your listeners, for example, have ever seen anybody use an asthma inhaler, the medicine that they take to breathe, that's effective at a very low dose. So there's been a sea change in the way we think about our exposures to chemicals. So it's no longer necessary for people to have the kind of exposures I would have had in the fish in my hometown, where it was at 77 parts per million, for someone to have a very serious exposure to chemicals. Now what people are concerned about are these tiny little doses that we get each and every day from, in fact, consumer products. And that the interesting thing about the FDA report, and I would encourage people to read, say, Pete Myers on that topic, he believed that the FDA report was very influenced by some of the science that had come out of industry as opposed to the science that would have come out of, say, academia.
And Pete Myers, who is he?
He wrote a book called Our Stolen Future.
Oh, that's right. And that was actually the first kind of crossover book that came into the public, you know, the more popular eye, that was about these endocrine disruptors.
Correct. And he's been widely quoted as being skeptical of the FDA report that says that bisphenol A is actually safe. And I think what the really important thing here for people is, look, you're a mom with a baby bottle, and you're trying to figure out things that are so incredibly complex and turns out to be controversial. But I think in going back to your question about the social construction of ignorance, doubt is our enemy. As consumers, we don't want doubt about our products. We don't want to think, my God, is this baby bottle safe? So we really need to rely on our government to regulate in a way that is fair and precautionary and not overly influenced by industry.
Yeah, you have a great image in the book, Lake Effect, and I'm speaking with Nancy Nichols, the author of Lake Effect. Somebody says something about, you know, if you see a baby floating down a river, you're going to jump in and save it. But if you see hundreds of babies floating down the river, you're going to say, my God, where are all these babies coming from?
Right. I mean, I think that it's possible to say, I mean, and I was influenced by this too. You know, I think I thought, oh my God, my sister was sick, and I was very compelled by her story. And yet it really wasn't until I got sick that I thought, wait, you know, one sister with ovarian cancer would have been enough. But two sisters with rare cancers in their 40s, and then, in fact, I was treated by some amazing physicians in Boston, and I went to see a very well-known geneticist, and she just rolled her eyes. I mean, that the odds of us both having rare cancers in our 40 was just so small. So it becomes the predominance, the one story after another, that makes people really start to think about these issues.
Well, so a lot of people would counter that argument by saying, well, you know, cancer is a genetic disease, you and your sister, it must be in your genes.
Right. And, of course, there's always a genetic component to cancer. It is a disease of genetic mutation, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a strict family inheritance. I think that people talk about, or scientists tell us, that it's the genes times the environment equation, that genes load the gun, but environment pulls the trigger. So clearly my sister and I had a genetic weakness, maybe even a genetic weakness that made it hard for us to clear toxins, but I do believe that it's some combination of our genetic predisposition and our environmental exposures.
You know, another point you make in the book that I thought was really interesting was the impact of pollution on the communities, not in the sense of environmental exposures, that is the health itself, but how those exposures, how the pollution affected the economic life of Waukegan.
Waukegan lost about 30,000 jobs in the aftermath of the discovery of the pollution and many of the economic problems that we now think of as the Rust Belt going away, the end of American manufacturing in the Midwest. The interesting thing that happened in my town was that when the middle-class manufacturing jobs left, there was a tremendous amount of flight from the community. In the absence of those people being there, huge numbers of Hispanics and Mexicans moved into town. Some of them are legal, some of them are not legal immigrants to this country. And that's created a whole problem of environmental justice, because the people now who have inherited the legacy of the pollution are the least capable in many ways of fighting it, either individually, as you know, within their own physical self, and also gathering together as a community. You can imagine, if you're new to this country, if you are don't speak the language and you are not a legal resident of this country, you're not actually going to get active in fighting years-old battles of pollution on the lakefront.
Making the connections there between the environment, economics, and the social dislocations.
Correct.
You write this book, Lake Effect, with the tremendous passion that does come from your personal experience and your personal tragedy. Was it hard to write the book?
Oh, it was impossibly hard to write the book. I was very sick, first of all, and I was took me about 5 years to write it, so I had a little office, and I would lay on the floor sometimes, and there were days when I cried all day, and there were days when I was sick all day. But I'm very, very pleased that I did it, and I hope that it's a helpful thing to other people. I really think that even though it's a difficult book, it's a hopeful book that we can prevail against some of the things in our environment that I believe are linked to problems in our health. And I hope people will read it and enjoy it in that spirit.
Well, Nancy Nichols, thanks so much. Your book is Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nancy Nichols is an independent journalist, editor, and broadcaster. Among other publications, her writing has appeared in the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times Book Review, the Harvard Business Review, and The Nation. The 7th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks was marked earlier this month. We have some time left in today's show to bring you the poet Martín Espada reading his memorial poem, Alabanza. He read it to us over the phone on the occasion of the 3rd anniversary of the attacks. Espada is America's best-known Latino poet. He teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst here, where we record the show. Espada told me he'd wanted to write a poem about the tragedy, but the event was too overwhelming to encompass in its entirety. So he decided to focus on one small part of it.
I began looking at the situation, particularly of the food service workers killed that day, particularly the members of a union called HERE, Local 100, Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees, Local 100. And they lost 43 members in one restaurant called Windows on the World on the 107th floor of Tower 1. Many of these workers were undocumented, and they were invisible in life, even more invisible in death. And that indeed some of their families couldn't even come forward to collect benefits or even to grieve publicly with everyone else because of their fear that they would be punished by the government because of their legal status. I should say that Alabanza is the title and a key word in the poem. It means praise in Spanish, and it comes from the verb alabar, which means, among other things, to celebrate with words. Alabanza. Praise the cook with a shaven head and a tattoo on his shoulder that said, Oye, a blue-eyed Puerto Rican with people from Fajardo, the harbor of pirates centuries ago. Praise the lighthouse in Fajardo, candle glimmering white to worship the dark saint of the sea, Alabanza. Praise the cook's yellow pirate's cap worn in the name of Roberto Clemente, his plane that flamed into the ocean loaded with cans for Nicaragua, for all the mouths chewing the ash of earthquakes, Alabanza. Praise the kitchen radio, dial clicked even before the dial on the oven so that music and Spanish rose before bread. Praise the bread, Alabanza. Praise Manhattan from 107 flights up like Atlantis glimpsed through the windows of an ancient aquarium. Praise the great windows where immigrants from the kitchen could squint and almost see their world, hear the chant of nations, Ecuador, Mexico, República Dominicana, Haiti, Yemen, Ghana, Bangladesh, Alabanza. Praise the kitchen in the morning where the gas burned blue on every stove and exhaust fans fired their diminutive propellers, hands cracked eggs with quick thumbs or sliced open cartons to build an altar of cans, Alabanza. Praise the busboy's music, the chime of his dishes and silverware in the tub, Alabanza. Praise the dish dog, the dishwasher, who worked that morning because another dishwasher could not stop coughing or because he needed overtime to pile the sacks of rice and beans for a family floating away on some Caribbean island plagued by frogs, Alabanza. Praise the waitress who heard the radio in the kitchen and sang to herself about a man gone, Alabanza. After the thunder, wilder than thunder, after the shutter deep in the glass of the great windows, after the radio stopped singing like a tree full of terrified frogs, after night burst the dam of day and flooded the kitchen, for a time the stoves glowed in darkness like the lighthouse in Fajardo, like a cook's soul. Soul, I say, even if the dead cannot tell us about the bristles of God's beard because God has no face. Soul, I say, to name the smoke beings flung in constellations across the night sky of this city and cities to come. Alabanza, I say, even if God has no face. Alabanza. when the war began from Manhattan and Kabul, two constellations of smoke rose and drifted to each other, mingling in icy air, and one said with an Afghan tongue, "Teach me to dance. We have no music here." And the other said with a Spanish tongue, "I will teach you. Music is all we have."
Poet Martín Espada reading his 9/11 elegy, Alabanza. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Next week, we talk with T.J. English about his best-selling book, Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. To find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming guests, visit our website at writersvoice.net. You can get our podcast there and hear archive shows, too. Please send your thoughts, comments, and questions to writersvoice@wmua.org. And thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.